Welcome to Let's Talk Legal, part of Coastal Daybreak every Tuesday morning and brought to you by Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. You can call in now to have your legal questions answered by attorneys Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Call in now with your questions at 252-247-7282.
Well, we brought in the reasonable facsimile this morning. That's Sam Morris is with us today. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Good morning, Ben. I'm cold, but other than that, I'm doing well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're looking at like 18 degrees in Richlands, 22 degrees in this area this morning. It's cold.
Yeah, the thermostat on my car on the way in this morning said it was like 19 or 20 degrees,
yeah.
Which for me is just as bad as negative 20, whatever.
Who
it's all
tell?
The same.
Who
it's,
can tell
it's
the
cold,
difference?
It's cold, yeah.
When you get down to a certain level, it's like, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, I woke up this morning and walked out the door, and I'm like, man, I moved back to Carteret County to get away from this kind of weather.
But yeah, that's right.
It followed me here, I guess.
Okay, what are we talking about today?
So, Ben, this morning I wanted to kind of take a step backwards from where we were last week. I believe Mr. Collins was in here last week, and Wes was talking about a lot of the kind of things that we see the day of trial and maybe right before trial. He went over things like the pretrial order, which is an agreement between the parties regarding various things like the admissibility of certain evidence, authentication of documents. He went through jury selection and talked about that whole process with strikes and removal from the panel for cause, that type of thing. But this morning I wanted to kind of go over just for purposes of our listeners and kind of demystify the process from when a client walks in our door to that day.
Okay.
And kind of go over what we're looking for as the attorneys from everything from the, you know, free initial consult that we do down the road at Harvell and Collins up until when we're in court picking the jury and getting ready to roll on all cylinders for trial.
When we started this show a long time ago now, in fact, I think Wes's kids were born.
I think he said something like he uses his oldest son, Casey, as a measuring stick for how long the radio show's been going. Yeah.
When we do that, we started with talking about a funnel, you know, how you start with like a giant funnel and then you're going to narrow things down until you get to actually into the courtroom with a lot of things. But on par, what do you think? 80% of the cases that come in don't go to jury? Don't go to a trial.
Well, you know, it's hard to tell just because I've never run the numbers on it. I know the national numbers, for example, show a very, very low percentage of cases that actually go through to a trial because there are so many steps along the way that, like you said, funnel down the issues and also kind of funnel down the incentive to go.
Right.
You've got court ordered mediation in a lot of circumstances. You have discovery, which either may or may not, help the plaintiff or the defendant.
The light
in the
bulb
case.
May go off at some point in time. Say, let's just settle this.
Absolutely, and sometimes it's the best. And you also have the things like the financial constraints of the parties. You know, you don't always have an endless pocketbook to go through and do everything that you know you might would like to do in the course of litigation because you're having to be mindful of the overall cost of everything.
Right.
And so, and you know, unfortunately, over the years, litigation costs have continued to rise. But at the same time, you have to be cognizant of that throughout the whole process to be able to make sure that, you know, for your client's perspective, that you're able to best help them in the process of getting what they need.
Okay, let's start with day one.
Okay, so day one, you know, at Harvell and Collins, like a lot of law firms, we do a free initial consult. The client comes into our office. They meet with me or Wes, or if it's an estate planning matter or a corporation matter or an LLC matter, something like that, they'll meet with Cecil or Andrew down the road. And what happens is they come in, they sit down with us, and we just start to talk about what the issue is. Sometimes the legal issue really isn't anything to really pursue. Sometimes it's just a matter of, hey, I've got a tree on my property. Do I need to cut it down? Is it posing a risk to my neighbor? Whose responsibility is it to cut it down if the tree limb is going over my neighbor's property, something like that?
Or it's coming back over to mine.
Exactly. Yeah. And you might just be able to tell them, hey, no, look, it's your responsibility to cut it down or tell your neighbor to cut it down. It's his responsibility. But there's no actual live controversy yet.
Okay.
It's kind of you know, the calm before the storm. However, oftentimes what happens is people will come in and they'll either be in a plaintiff's position or a defendant's position.
The tree fell.
Or maybe they have a contract dispute with somebody and they want us to start the process by doing a demand letter. Or maybe they've been served with a complaint, which we can talk about in a minute, and they need a defense counsel to be able to respond to the complaint and help them throughout the litigation. And those types of files, you know, we're looking at if we're on the plaintiff's side, because we do both. We're both the plaintiff's lawyer and the defendant's lawyer in various cases. Not in the same case. We can't be. But
right.
But we do both plaintiff and defense work. We're looking at for the plaintiff side when they come in, they're telling us all these facts, and the client oftentimes doesn't necessarily know what the legally relevant facts are. But we're mm-hmm. sitting back and we've got kind of this funnel in our brain, and we're taking notes, seeing, okay, they said X, they said Y, they said Z, they've got a cause of action for breach of contract, or they've got a cause of action for breach of covenant, or mm-hmm. something like that. And we start categorizing these claims, and then we kind of will go through as the lawyer on this end and explain to them, these are the causes of action that we think that you have. Do you want to pursue them? This is probably what it will cost to pursue them. And then we go from there, and if they say, yes, I want to absolutely pursue it, then we go ahead and we start the next phase of the process, which is doing the demand letter.
Okay. All right. And what constitutes, what's in a demand letter?
A demand letter is a formal letter normally by the lawyer's office. It's going to have the firm letterhead on the top of it, all that kind of stuff. But basically, it's a letter that kind of I like to think of it as kind of the shot across the bow.
Mm-hmm.
What it is it's letting the other party know that they are currently violating one of your rights in something, whether it's they're failing to perform under a contract, they're trespassing on your property, they've done some kind of harm for which the law provides a remedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that demand letter does is it'll outline a brief factual summary of what, you know, the relevant facts are. It will then kind of go through and establish the various, you know, theories of liability that we might have. And then it will make, as it's called, a demand,
mm-hmm.
saying, hey, you know, we're willing to forgo suit on these claims for, you know, a certain amount of money, or for you to cease and desist doing some sort of action. Maybe
right.
you've got a shed on someone else's property and you want it moved, something like that. That's kind of, you know, a cease and desist letter can be kind of the same thing as a demand letter. It's
right,
kind of
same idea.
Yeah, same idea. And so that's what the letter does. It kind of sets forth, you know, hey, we've got legal claims. We're willing to not pursue them if you do, you know, X. And if that doesn't work, then we go from there and we move on to the world of civil litigation.
Well, the demand letter just lets the person who's receiving it know that the person sending it means business.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. It shows that they've been brought to that point in their either professional or personal relationship with the other person where they feel like they need to have a lawyer involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the simple fact that having a lawyer's demand letter with firm letterhead and all that stuff, for whatever reason, it kind of gets people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
That the party now is really being serious about this. And, you know, our goal at all times is to make the litigation process as easy as it can be for the client. And it starts with the demand letter. And a well-crafted demand letter, you know, our primary hope is that it will resolve the matter in a way that is, you know, that makes our client happy with minimal expense.
Does the demand letter include like a date certain of response?
Absolutely, yeah. We're not going to just demand that they do something at some point in the future. We're going to give them kind of a timeline for performance, and that's going to be determined by, you know, the relative task at hand. If it requires them to produce some sort of documentation or something, we're going
right.
to kind of factor that in and say, hey, they might have some time to have to go through the channels to get it. But if it requires them just to move their shed, we might say, hey, 10 days.
Yeah, right. Okay. Is there a sense of reasonableness, or is there law surrounding this about that?
Absolutely. You know, the critical portion of the demand letter, I kind of think of it as kind of, like I said before, a shot across the bow, but it kind of gives you a framework for what the complaint could look like if
mm-hmm.
it's filed.
Mm-hmm.
It's telling the other party, look, you're in violation of, you know, X statute, or you're in you've got Y theory of liability against
mm-hmm.
you. You need to correct your action because we can go to court on these types of theories. And, you know, our goal the whole way across the board is to make sure that we're not, you know,
make your client whole again.
Yeah, really. Make our client whole again, and at the same time, not unnecessarily, you know, reinventing the wheel, so to speak, with our client. And if we have a well-crafted demand letter that ends on the front end, kind of outlines the theory of liabilities and all that stuff, it kind of goes ahead and gives us an outline of how we need to style our complaint if we
mm-hmm.
need to file it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have a date in there
mm-hmm.
that you want these things accomplished by, or whatever, however you want to pursue that. Then what?
Then
you're waiting for a response.
Then you wait for a response. Sometimes you'll get a letter saying, "Hey, we're gonna abide by the terms of the demand letter. We're gonna honor the request. We'll have this done. We might need a little more time,
mm-hmm.
but it at least shows good faith step to resolve the issue."
Okay.
But then sometimes you might get a response that says, "You know, I don't.
We deny it.
We deny it. I don't owe your client anything, or you know, something along those lines." And at that point, you know, okay, the parties have taken kind of a stone. You know, they're kind of taken their
They've drawn their position. And
they have
drawn
their line in the sand, and at this point, we're going to have to go to court to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the demand letter is kind of like, you know, you hear the buzzword sometimes, alternative dispute resolution. It's kind of like that in the sense that you're trying to resolve a dispute outside of the court, but when that doesn't work, you end up having to go to the court.
Okay.
And so that's going to be started by the commencement of a lawsuit, which is really started by the filing of a complaint.
Okay. And what is entitled, before we take a break, what's basic composition of a complaint?
The complaint is what we call in the legal world a formal pleading. It's a document that we file with the court that gives, kind of like the demand letter, a more detailed explanation of the facts that are surrounding the litigation.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happened on X date. They entered this contract on January 15th of 2017. The defendant failed to perform under the contract, and then it outlines the various causes of action. So breach of contract, negligent, trespass to property, all these types of things. It'll then outline the each cause of action. It'll reassert allegations. It'll make demand for certain types of damages. And it's basically, I mean, it's the formal pleading that we file with the court that's going to end up shaping the entire lawsuit.
Is a copy of that sent to the defendant?
It is. It's sent with the sent to the defendant with a civil summons, and that's kind of what's going to lead us into our discussion over acquiring jurisdiction over the defendant to be able to bring him into court.
All right, that's coming up next. Here, as we're talking with Sam Morris from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. If you'd like to join us, you can reach out to us by calling 247-7282. We're also on Facebook Live at Coastal Daybreak on the talk station. You can ask a question there too. Back here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station, and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and Sam Morris is in today. We're talking about the process of going to court. So you're ready to file. So tell me, kind of walk me through that physical step. Do you actually walk it to the courthouse or run it to the courthouse?
You either walk it or run it, depending upon when the filing deadline is. If it's got to be served, or if it's got to be filed by, you know, the day that you're going to file and it's 4 o'clock, you need to be running it to the courthouse.
Yeah.
But yeah, ordinarily what's going to happen is, you know, you have your complaint, you drafted it, you make sure that you've outlined all of the theories of the case, because the complaint, like you've said before, the funnel, the complaint's going to funnel down all those facts that your client told you, and it's going to funnel down all the theories of liability that's going to shape the entire lawsuit. And then what you do is you or your staff member or whoever is going to take it to the courthouse.
And where in the courthouse?
The civil clerk's office.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to take it in there, and they're going to file the complaint. They go to the clerk's office. They'll stamp it. It'll have a filed stamp on there, a date and time of when it was filed. And then you, once it's been filed with their office, you go back. And you have to, you get a summons issued, and then you have to go and serve it on
now,
the defendant.
Now, do you automatically get a summons issued?
Generally, yeah. I mean, what's going to happen is you're going to go there, and you're going to have your paperwork for the summons.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be separate from the complaint, and you're going to end up getting them both at the same time.
What's in the summons?
The summons is it's basically a formal, what's in the summons?
You've been served.
It's a form, yeah. It's a form that ends up doing exactly what you said. You've been served, but it is a vitally important part of the litigation, because the service of the summons and the complaint on the defendant is ordinarily the way that the court is going to establish personal jurisdiction over the over the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's vitally important, because in order for the lawsuit to move forward, in order for the plaintiff to be able to recover anything of the defendant, the court and where they sued has to be able to, you know, reach
say,
out.
Say this is ours.
Yeah, exactly. They have to be able to take ownership of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And if the defendant has no, you know, contacts with the area or anything like that, it can be hard to do that.
So summonses get challenged.
They can be, yeah. If they're served untimely, if you've let the time period go by without serving the summons. If you're not able to effectuate service within the time frame, you've not made a request for what's called an alias in pluri summons, which is an extension of that summons, your summons can be ineffective. And if the summons is ineffective, your service is ineffective. And if your service is ineffective, there's no jurisdiction over the person.
Yeah.
And that's an critically important part, because, I mean, our U.S. Supreme Court has gone through cases upon cases of what's called personal jurisdiction questions. Because the whole idea is the due process clause requires that there be due process before a judgment's going to be entered against a person. One of those things is that you have to be able to defend yourself in a lawsuit. And if you've not been either personally served or the court doesn't have some alternative basis to exert jurisdiction over you, there can be a big problem. There's a big case now in North Carolina. Andrew's talked about it before on the tax show. The U.S. Supreme Court just granted certiorari review on it, and that involves whether a wholly out-of-state trust, for example, formed in New York, has never made a beneficiary payment or anything like that, but yet one of the beneficiaries, which is a separate person from the trust, it's not the same entity, lives in North Carolina. Can North Carolina tax that trust, even though the trust really has no contacts with North Carolina? And so that's a big question that's at the very beginning of the lawsuit. So point being is that get it right from the beginning when it comes to service of process, because you don't want to be litigating personal jurisdiction at the U.S. Supreme Court and spending a lot of dollars on that.
Yeah.
And you've not even gotten discovery
nothing,
yet.
Nothing's happened yet
exactly.
on your case. Yeah. So, all right. So the service of the summons is good. The summons is good, et cetera. What happens next?
So once the service has happened, the defendant's been given the complaint. They've got a specific time period to respond. It's ordinarily 30 days, but it can be different depending upon whether other documents are attached to the complaint. But most of the time, it's 30 days. And what happens there, and this is, you know, one of the critical points of the litigation, is that the defendant is going to go through paragraph by paragraph of the complaint, and they are going to either admit or deny the allegations.
So there's some stipulations here.
There can be. Yeah. It's one of those things where if you don't respond to something in the complaint, for example, that can be determined to be judicially admitted. And if it's judicially admitted, you can't contest it later on in the case.
Right.
So it's very, you know, you might have a paragraph. You know, I've seen some complaints where they'll have, you know, multiple sentences in a paragraph, and you have to be very careful to make sure that you're responding to each allegation or something like that. Because if you respond, you know, if the first sentence says that the contract was entered on January 3rd, 2014, and the second sentence says something like you breached the contract on January 5th, 2016 or whatever it was, and you just deny the first part of it, but you've not denied the second part, you can have issues later on down the road.
Right.
And so it's very important you go through each of the paragraphs, and the paragraphs in the complaint are numbered. You know, they've got to be clearly identified, all of that. And the defendant then is going to either answer, they're going to answer by either agreeing with the allegation or denying the allegation. And then they might assert what we call counterclaims. And what's going to happen there is that, you know, ordinarily there are two types of counterclaims. There are what we call compulsory counterclaims, and then they're called permissive counterclaims.
Okay, so these either defense or a refutation of the things that are going on in the complaint, and then the counterclaims, is that all also filed in the court? Does that end up just getting in a great big file?
Exactly, same type of thing. You're going to file it with the courthouse. You're going to serve it on the answer.
File and serve.
Exactly. Now the answer won't have anything like a summons or anything with it because the party's already agreed to jurisdiction because they filed the plaintiff's already agreed to jurisdiction because they filed the complaint. But
all this gets exchanged, though, with the court being kind of the holding party.
Exactly. The court's court sitting there as the umpire.
The repository of all.
They are the repository of the information. They're the umpire calling balls and strikes, and that's its job. But you raise a good point. And one thing I forgot to mention, which is very important with the answer, is the fact that you're going to also go ahead and state all your affirmative defenses. So we've got, you know, affirmative defenses that are under Rule 12.
What does that mean?
What that means is basically they're defenses that you can raise at the beginning of the lawsuit that show that, you know, oftentimes it's some sort of procedural or substantive failure on part of the plaintiff. For example, if you've brought litigation after the time period to bring it, the statute of limitations is run. That's a defense.
So if there was ever a motion to dismiss, they would all be raised.
Exactly. You're going to go ahead and raise them all in your answer, or you might file a pre-answer motion raising all your what's called the 12B defenses. That's under Rule 12B of North Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure. You've got 12B1, which is involving personal jurisdiction, 12B6, which is
a lot of stuff,
statute of limitations, things that lawyers know and talk about all the time, but they're critically important to go ahead and raise them in your answer.
Okay, we'll have more to come in a moment here with Sam Morris from Harvell & Collins, Attorneys at Law. We're back with Sam Morris talking about the legal proceedings that happen when you file suit, and we're up to that point of, I guess we're almost to discovery, right?
We're almost there, yeah. I mean, we were briefly talking about counterclaims and with the answer and all that. And
affirmative defenses.
Affirmative defenses. One thing I want to mention with the counterclaims is that, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but like I was saying earlier, you've got things that are called compulsory counterclaims and permissive counterclaims. The compulsory counterclaims are claims that you have to raise in this litigation or else you can't raise them later. So, for example, the car might hit another car or something like that, and then you raise a defense of they were negligent too or something like that, but
right.
you want to sue them for something arising out of that same car accident.
Right.
That is a compulsory counterclaim. The idea there is that if you have a claim that arises out of the same set of facts, you have to bring it in that lawsuit or else you can't bring it later. However, though, let's say that person also owes you money because they, you know, bought a dog from you 6 months
right.
before they were paid you, something like that.
Right.
Just you can pick whatever you want it to be. You can also raise that as a counterclaim in the lawsuit, believe it or not. It might not make things very clean, but you can absolutely raise a permissive counterclaim in the lawsuit. The court sometimes might separate that issue out into its own lawsuit.
Judge Judy doesn't like those.
Yeah, you might. Yeah, Judge Judy might not like those, but the court will sometimes carve those out and have a separate lawsuit depending upon how unrelated they
right,
are.
Right, right. Okay.
But, yeah.
All right, so we're up to that part through the claims now. Now you need to find out.
Yep, we keep going down our funnel. You know, we're getting narrower and narrower. We have the complaint, we've got the answer, the refinement of the issues, but now we're really getting to the refinement process, the trial by fire, so to speak, of discovery.
People think that before you even walk in to make a claim or say that you have to know everything about what's going on.
You have to know as much as you can know.
Yeah.
You should know as much as you can know, but the problem is that there's a lot of information in a lawsuit that you don't know until you've got a subpoena out and you can actually depose somebody.
You can see a bank record or any documents or other things.
Exactly. The smoking gun in litigation is not always very clear. And, you know, your client oftentimes is coming to you with a perspective of, this is what I know has happened so far, but they might not have all the information. Well, the discovery process is designed to go ahead and, you know, accumulate this information, prepare it for trial, know what's going to happen at trial, and that way the lawyers can, you know, accurately prepare. They can go ahead and get all their ducks in a row for presentation of the issues and the facts to the jury. But what the discovery process is it's going to involve both request for production of documents, questions to the opposing side, requesting answers under oath. We're going to have what's called deposition testimony, which a lot of people might have, you know, seen on, you know, certain TV
right.
shows or something like that. Or, you know, it's kind of similar to, you know, someone even testifying before Congress in the sense of you have someone under oath. They're being asked questions by oftentimes it's the opposing counsel, and they're going ahead and getting them committed to certain answers. And then that way, if their story changes before a trial, we can at least show that, hey, once we've gotten here in front of a jury, your story's changed.
Yeah, yeah. So you have that. And depositions are under oath. I mean, so they have that force of law.
They absolutely do. And, you know, that's one of the important things about the discovery process is that you're preparing for trial all along the way, and you're setting up for maybe impeaching a witness.
If you want to find out more, go to HarvellandCollins.com or call them for an appointment.